Hi, this is Franz Nicolai, and you're listening to the Hood Rat Recap Podcast.
Kissing cousins always said that it was for fun. It was a joke when we all wore our pajamas in the sun. Hallelujah, Speedo, and looking for a ride. I met somebody at a party. Drinking mushroom tea with the sailors on the sea. Getting high on the cheap stuff to save the economy. I'm never going back to the quarter. When the lights go out at the party, I got you.
I want you. We got bored. So we started a podcast about the best bar band in the land, man. This is the Hood Rat Recap, and we are back. We are your steady stream of the unified scene, all the news, reviews of the band that you love, we love, and it's all about the cattle and the creeping things, especially the creepy things late here in October. Hello, everybody. This is Stage Right Mike on the mic, and I can talk hold steady all night. And when I like to talk hold steady heavy, I throw up the rat signal, and just like that, the Hood Rat Pack has assembled. Hark! I can hear the unified scene's very own King of Queens. He's Gasper, the friendly co-host. Gasper, how's it going today?
Doing pretty good, Mike. But you know what? I've been trying to get people to call me Kerouac.
Why is that, Gasper?
Because I'm all about the journey.
How's that working out for you?
Not so good. Not so good, man. People keep calling me MapQuest.
Ooh. Kevin, what do you have to say about that?
Kevin's not here.
Well, that's right. Kevin's not here today.
Yeah, Kevin, unfortunately, got called away on some work, so he won't be joining us today, but that means I get to get away with a Freddie Knuckles and not get made fun of.
We'll let the people decide that.
All right, so we have a great show for you today. Very excited about the guest we have, but before we reveal who that is, wanted to talk a little bit about Silver Patriot States, which is a tribute record to Jesse Malin. Mike, have you had a chance to check that out yet?
Yes, I've listened to many of the tracks. Of course, I listened to the Hold Steady track, and I'm starting to listen to some of the other ones. Really neat stuff. I'm enjoying all of it.
It's a heck of a lineup on this record. I mean, Dinosaur Jr., Frank Turner, Spoon, Bruce Springsteen, the Hold Steady. There's just so many. And it really is a great record. But what did you think about Death Star, the Hold Steady cover?
Yeah, first of all, I love that name. Here we are getting the Star Wars, you know, which I thought was perfect for the Hold Steady. You know, we've got the Tusken Raiders. We got the Star Wars hips from Lifter Polar. So I was happy to get the Star Wars name. So I thought that was pretty neat. And I thought it was a pretty cool song. It sounded like it could have been Thrashing Through the Passion to me. What did you think?
I really enjoyed it, man. Their version, I mean, and it's really just because they're such a full band now between Franz and Steve and Tad and everybody. It's such a full sound. And the original is kind of more of a, not stripped down, but a more, minimalist compared to what the Hold Steady did. So the original song, both songs to me sound like they have kind of almost like a greaser vibe to them, like not quite 50s music, but like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, and the Hold Steady spin on it, I thought was awesome. Not so much lyrically, surprisingly, because I mean, this is a song where Jesse kind of talks, sings already, and that's Craig's thing. So like, there wasn't a huge difference other than that it's in Craig's voice. The real difference here was the musicianship on the record was like, it was just such a brighter, fuller take. I really liked it. I was kind of curious, like, did your ears perk up? Well, first I should ask, are you a Jesse Malin fan? Like, is he somebody you listen to regularly, or did you listen to that for this particular record?
I listened to it for this record. He's not someone I listen to regularly, but now I'm interested in doing so just because of I went and listened to a bunch of his solo stuff, and I listened to a lot of this album. So now I think I will be a fan because it's
I kind of did the same. I felt like I might have missed out on this one because he does have a lot of great stuff, and Degeneration's got a lot of great stuff. But as a result, because I'm always cueing in on the lyrics, did your ears perk up when he hit the lyric "Hallelujah Speedo"? Went looking for a ride. I was like, wait a second.
My ears perked up quite a few times. It did sound like almost Hold Steady lyrics. I thought 3 or 4 times in the song. So I thought it was really appropriate. Yeah.
But I'm really digging the cover. I'm digging the album total. I mean, that was our intro music on this episode. So we think you should definitely check it out. The record's for a great cause. As you know, this is part of the Sweet Relief Foundation, helping out Jesse with his medical needs. So check out that record, man.
Yeah. And then Dinosaur Jr. got Brooklyn. I wonder, Hold Steady, do you think they would have chose Brooklyn if they had first choice? Maybe they didn't have first choice, but
it's funny you bring that up. Actually, that was something me and Heather were talking about recently. Do you think when these type of records come together, like, how much choice do you get? Is it the type of thing where, like, hey, I really want to cover this song? Or is it, you know, a producer kind of, I kind of wish Kevin was here because he'd be the perfect person to ask for this. Like, does a producer or does the band or someone at the label turn around and say, well, no, we want this band to do this song and this band to do that song because we think it fits? Because I would almost imagine with certain bands that if you were to do a tribute record to, like, there'd be a fist fight over certain songs where it's like, no, I want to do the really cool song.
I think it's like getting your favorite number on a sports team. I think the earlier you get there, you know, the earlier you sign on, the more chance you have to get your song. But then after that, you kind of get whatever allowed it afterwards. So I think it's kind of a catch or catch can. Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll have to ask Kevin to be the deciding factor. I know he's put together records like this, or at least been part of that, but I'd be curious to find out.
What movies are we talking about?
Or is it the long-lost series ending to The Office?
Or is it why your exes should stay exes?
Find out on the Or Is It Movie Podcast.
Or is it the Lego Movie version for Crayola?
Or is it how not to attract beautiful deaf women?
We're on Spotify, Apple iTunes, and everywhere you get your favorite podcasts.
Or is it Shared Groundhog Day?
Or is it Titty Bouncy the Movie?
So are you ready to get into the real reason why we're here, our special guest today?
Very big guest today. And what I love doing about this show is every time we meet someone from the community, you're like, they can't be as nice as they seem. And then as soon as we meet them, they always exceed that. And they're always nicer than we could hope for. And I'm really excited for everybody to hear this one.
Yeah, this one's really great. So, I mean, as you might have guessed from the title of our episode, Franz Nicolai joined us to talk about Band People, his new book. The title of the book is Band People, Life and Work in Popular Music. It's in bookstores now, and you can check it out everywhere. And we had a really great conversation with him. So what do you think, Mike? You want to get into it?
Let's get into it.
Let's do it. Hey, want to welcome Franz Nicolai to the show. Thank you so much for joining us. We're here today to talk about Band People, his new book, Band People, Life and Work in Popular Music. So thank you very much for joining us, Franz.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So before we jump into some of our questions, you want to just, for the listeners that may not have read the book, tell us a little bit about what Band People is about.
Sure. I mean, Band People is about that. It covers all kinds of support musicians and sort of collective creativity in general. In book events, there's a little 3-paragraph passage I've been reading that sort of lays it out, but I can sort of summarize it right now, which is that there's, you know, it's about this bizarre institution that we have, for the last 60 years. That's a combination of chosen family, creative collaboration, small business, that we call a rock band, that, people end up doing for their career if they're lucky. But a lot of them have sort of sign up for that before they really know what they're signing up for. And so I was interested in identifying that community of people, identifying what the sort of guild skills that were required, and laying some of them out and just sort of, I guess, convening a virtual roundtable of band people on the topic. Our Babajan, my buddy drummer, says in the book, which is maybe a more concise way of saying it, some nights I feel like a golden god, and some nights I feel like an ambitious t-shirt salesman with entitlement issues. Well, I think that sort of sums up that combination of, you know, occasional glamour and, you know, matched with sort of workaday quotidian labor.
Well, one thing that's evident is that a tremendous amount of research went into this project. How long does it take to complete something like this?
Well, it's not an easy answer with this book because I stopped working on it for a few years. I started working on it in 2015 and 16. That's when I did the bulk of the interviews. Anyone who's ever done that sort of work knows that it's really fun to interview, and, you know, for some of us, really fun to research. It's way less fun to transcribe. And so I sort of got beached on the shoals of transcription for a while, and then eventually I hired someone to do it. But also, I couldn't find anyone to be particularly interested in the book. I had an agent who was sort of pushing me towards, you know, a vision of it that was more about, again, like putting the spotlight on the more famous people that the subjects of the book worked for, and trying to get more gossipy, more salacious. And it just wasn't the kind of book that I wanted to write. And so I sort of gave up on it for a little while and wrote the novel instead. And then eventually came back to it and managed to turn the 6-inch pile of transcriptions and research into a 105,000 word book. Not without tremendous stress and strain. And finally, you know, my wife eventually said, you need to either knuckle down and finish this thing or put it in the drawer forever. But either way, you have to stop complaining about it. So, that's more or less what happened.
You bring up the novel Someone Should Pay You for Your Pain. And then, of course, you wrote The Humorous Ladies of Border Control. These are three very different books, both in genre and style. Do you have a preferred genre or style when you're writing, or these are just three different projects that you took on different ways?
My preference is to follow one thing by something as different as possible. so that I don't, you know, I'm not particularly a creature of routine. And one of the things I realized after I became a parent is that whereas before that I could have a bunch of different projects going on at a time, I could be writing songs for this, I could be writing music for that, I could be writing an article here and there, that really I was only going to have time for one project at a time. So the big question is going to be, what is that project at any given time? And so I'm trying to sort of alternate between, you know, it's nonfiction book, solo record, book of fiction, hold steady record, you know, the band people, and, you know, it's a little bit of a question what the next one is going to be. I have a couple things on the burners.
Cool. Yeah. I'm deep into the Humorous Ladies of Border Control. I'm listening to the audio version, and sure. And you read the audio, correct?
Yeah, for my sins.
And I love when authors read it. Is there like a temptation to re-edit as you're going back and reading it, going, oh, I should have said it this way? Is that,
yes.
Is there ever that temptation to do that?
100%. And one of the big things, I learned a lot from the process of reading that audiobook. And one of them is to always read everything out loud before I publish it. Because one of the things that I found in the recording studio for that audiobook is a tremendous number of typos and word choices that I would have changed. And some of them, they let me change at the last minute, and some of them they didn't. I still have a notes document if there's ever a second edition. You know, and it's tremendously painful because by the time you get to that point, you're so sick of the stupid project. One of my mentors once told me that you never finish a book, you just turn away in disgust. And I found that to be 100% true. After a certain point, you know, of all the editing and rewriting and copy editing and proofreading, and fact-checking, it just becomes physically painful to open the document. And after I send it off, there's like nothing I want. You know, that's why I said for my sins, it felt like the final punishment. It's like, oh, now, you know, for the final punishment, you have to read every word of this out loud. Yeah, they just sold the audio rights for band people and said, hey, do you want to read it? And I was like, you know what? I'll take the check for the license and I will leave the reading of it to the professionals.
I had to knuckle down to read this because I haven't sat down to read a book, admittedly, in a long time. I've been a big audiobook fan myself just because it's so much easier going back and forth to work. So I hunted for the audio version of Band People. I'm like, damn, it's not there. But cool. I'm glad it's coming out.
Yeah, I don't know when. I don't think they've cast it or anything. Okay. But it is, in theory, coming out at some point.
So one of the things that struck me reading Band People is that this could easily be considered an important resource for music business studies. Do you think this book will help new bands, aspiring musicians, to better grasp some of the more complex concepts you discuss? And if there were one lesson to take from the book that you could underscore and be like, I want to make sure everyone gets this one, what would it be?
Yeah, you know, that's when we did the Hold Steady book event in Chicago last year. Jessica Hopper was interviewing us, and she asked me that. You know, she was like, "Do you know you have this book coming out? Do you think it's going to help young bands?" And I thought about it for a second, and I actually think probably not, because anyone who's been around band people knows that there's nothing more that they like to read than musician memoirs and books about bands, band bios. And all of those basically have the same stations of the cross in terms of the stumbling blocks for bands around, you know, ego and songwriting credits and emergent hierarchies and addiction. And and yet we make those same mistakes over and over again. So I think there's probably an aspect of it that's a little bit like romantic relationships, where you can read all the romance novels and see all the rom-coms that you want, but you still have to make those same mistakes for yourself.
Right. That's fair. Specifically, in my head, one of the things was like, so you mentioned, and maybe this doesn't work out that way, but in the book you mentioned that music groups often have a defined model for roles, where rock bands, especially younger ones, tend to lack that type of structure. Do you think that it might make a newer band start to think that way, where it's the idea of like the democratic band versus defined roles is something like, I myself, when I was younger, playing around with the idea of being a band, like never thought about that. It was a very interesting point.
Yeah, I mean, it can't hurt to think about like the earlier you think about these things, the better, and it's ideally before there's, you know, before there's money at stake, right. Because the pressures come quickly, and they come unexpectedly. And then it becomes really hard to talk about them, because it usually comes when you have a whole bunch of other stuff going on and a lot of people asking you to do a lot of different things. And it's hard to have those conversations at those times. So I think if you can have those conversations early in your career as a band and stick to them, the better off you're going to be. I mean, there's a reason, you know, there are certain bands that people I talk to brought up unprompted over and over again that become iconic for certain kinds of templates that they offer, you know? And so people talk about U2 and REM and Radiohead and the way they agreed, as, you know, early on to share all their songwriting credits. And people are just fascinated by that because that's so unusual, especially at the really high levels, you know, as opposed to what happened to Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, for instance. You know, so they all get rich together. And you know, I think it's not for nothing that they have had a notable lack of acrimony over multiple decades as bands. So, you know, that's the sort of thing I think one of the reasons why publishing and songwriting become such tense subjects and troublesome subjects is because for a younger band full of idealism and romance, the details of the legalities of copyright are either inexplicable or don't seem all that interesting. And yet that's one of those things that, you know, breaks up a lot of bands, as Adam Gopnik likes to write about. I've seen him in more than one article say a version of the line that, you know, the story of every band breakup in the end turns out to be about songwriting, song publishing. And, you know, it's because that's one of those things that young people don't know about or don't think about. And, you know, comes into play when more experienced people start talking to you. So if people can start having those conversations early, I think that might be a handy thing.
And then Franz, I was kind of wondering, you know, like there's always that old trope that people do their best songwriting when they're going through a breakup or getting divorced, you know, they'll put out great material. Do you think that's true about bands too? Like I'm trying to think of like Fleetwood Mac doing Rumors. Like when a band's under strife, can that help them put out, like write better, put out better material or not?
I don't think it's a hard and fast rule. You know, it depends on how, you know, if you're talking about the lyricist, it depends on how autobiographical their lyrics are to begin with. Hmm. You know, I think, you know, think about someone like Laura Jane Grace, who I remember her saying in an interview once talking about her songwriting that it's basically diaristic, you know, it's basically straight out of the diary. And you can tell by the way the lyrics scan in the lines, you know, they're squeezed in there. They're not always rhyming, you know, they can be awkward sometimes, you know, and her records. And I think she's a great songwriter. Like when something really dramatic is happening in her life, you know, early on, she's enthused about anarchism or she's getting yelled at about selling out or, you know, like, or she's going through this very public transition, a great record comes out. You know, some of those intermediate times where she's just on the road, you get a lot of songs about hotel rooms, and that's just what you sign up for with that kind of songwriter. You know, I think bands, because it depends so much on chemistry of a particular lineup, if the discovery of that chemistry can be really exciting and invigorating. And so I think a lot of times that's why like a second or third record can be really exciting for a band. You know, you've sort of figured out what you are and then you're coming into your full strength. Right. Mm-hmm. But I don't think if those are also the records that make you, that take you from this level to this level, that can be also where some of those emergent hierarchies and tensions and pressures come into play, that make it hard to harness that chemistry that you've discovered and then ride it farther. But I don't think there's anything inherent about bands that means that the stressful times or the exciting times or the discovery times make for better records. I think there's just as many examples of people, you know, making records from a place of peace and comfort. You know, to the extent that people like stay positive, like as we've said, like that was the easy record to make. That was a time. That was a time of writing and recording that we all think back on with fondness.
Right.
It's not a happy record. You know, it's a dark record. But it was a happy time for the band.
So you touch upon how the book goes into some of the more challenging and uncomfortable aspects of being a music professional. Was it difficult to get people to talk about these topics?
It was not. And to the extent that people ask me what was the most surprising thing about the process of the book, I think that was the most surprising thing. I think, you know, you're talking to people by and large who are not interviewed a lot. But you are talking to people who are grown adults, professionals in their career who've been at it for a long time. And like anyone in a job, have spent a lot of time thinking about what that job is and what their role in the ecosystem of their workplace and of their field is. And so when asked openly and frankly, have been thinking about this stuff for a long time. And, you know, if you're lucky, can be quite articulate about it. Yeah.
Even under the backdrop of they know this is going into a book. And because some of the stories are a little bit like, wow, I'm surprised they were talking about that. But
well, I offered everyone, I'm not trying to get people in trouble,
right,
or trying to cause controversy. So I said up front, you know, hey, I'm happy to anonymize if you want to anonymize. I'm happy to go off the record. For the most part, people didn't do that. couple off the record stories that I, but they weren't crucial to the book. So it wasn't a big deal for me. And you'll notice that there's a couple stories in there that are anonymized, and that's not a big deal either.
Right.
You know, I think you're talking about, again, like people who are decades, in some cases, deep into their careers. And so, you know, think about a long marriage, the things that you and your partner have fought about in the past are not secrets to either of you. You've had those conversations.
Right.
And I have to assume that the same thing is true about the creative and business relationships that some of these people have with their other band members or their band leaders. Like, they've had those conversations and they're right. still a band, and that's why they're still a band.
So the book tour, which was awesome, by the way, I went to the event in New York. You got to kind of co-do these things with a bunch of really amazing musicians, Jay Gonzalez, Stuart Boogie, Betty Horowitz, among others. Was there a particular appearance where you got to discuss the book that stands out for you? And if so, why?
Well, I sort of split it up. You know, half of them are with the more traditional writer journalist types. And then half of them are with musicians. Mm. And for the most part, musicians who are in the book. So that was, I was right. sort of interested to see, you know, how to talk to them too, and be like, how did you feel about your portrayal in the book? Like, what was it like to read the book? Did you feel like I got anything wrong? Did you feel like I missed anything? You know, cause you're writing this for two audiences. One is, you know, the non-band person who might be curious about the inner workings of bands, or might see that, you know, be able to make the analogy between our peculiar kind of workplace and your own peculiar kind of workplace that, you know, everybody works with teams of people that have to get along in various ways and figure out how much of yourself to bring to a project and so on. But the other audience, of course, is the community that I'm trying to describe. And you want them to feel like I want them to feel like I got it right, and to feel like I captured something about that life that hadn't been kept, that they hadn't seen in print before. And so I've been really gratified to find that they did, for the most part, you know, to field those text messages being like, hey, I just read your book. You know, you really nailed it, like that sort of thing. I think band people are not, for the most part, used to that genre of performance. The book talk, you know, I know Stuart was really anxious. you know, I think a lot about genres of performance, right? So people ask me sometimes, do you get stage fright? And what I've come to understand is that I get stage fright every time I do a different kind of performance for the first time. So in my career as a musician, it was every time I stepped up a level. Right. The first time we played the Bowery Ballroom, first time on TV, first time on a festival stage, super nervous. But second, third time, not nervous. And I think, you know, being on stage to talk is not something that a lot of musicians are called upon to do. Most people don't go to book events. So like, what does this look like? Is something you have to talk through. Like there's a form to it in the same way that there's a form to going to a rock club. You know what to expect. You know, right. you know what happens when the house lights go down and the song comes up, and you know the facade of the what going off stage before the encore and so on and so forth. And so, you know, there's a comfort level with the performance practices of a particular performance genre. I mean, someone like Benny Horowitz is, you know, he does a podcast. So he talks to people all the time. I knew he was going to feel comfortable in front of a mic.
Right.
But you know, Jay doesn't do that sort of thing very often. Stuart doesn't do that sort of thing very often.
But it was definitely cool to watch.
Yeah. I think, you know, and Stuart was saying, you know, that he experienced reading the book as like it brought up a lot for him. You know, it was very emotional for him. I think, you know, there's a lot of this stuff that we don't talk about, or that we only talk about sort of privately when you see someone once a year when they come through on tour. And so I thought there was going to be a utility to laying it out there and saying, hey, look, you know, we're all thinking about this stuff. Here's how your peers handle it. Here's how, you know, person X does it. Person Y does it in a completely different way. That was part of the what was interesting about the project for me is, you know, I started doing it at a time where I had come off the road for the first time in my adult life. And so I was sort of it afforded me that kind of perspective on this thing that I had devoted the first 15 years of my adult life to at the time, to say, you know, to look back and say, wow, you know, what were the choices I made? How could I have made those choices differently? How do other people make those choices differently? You know, how do they understand the same sort of work?
Well, mine's a little more off subject, but so we're kind of talking about the longevity of bands here, and you know, the Hold Steady's going into their 21st year, their third decade, and you know, us on the podcast here, we really love the eighth. Well, we love all the albums, but we really love the eighth and ninth one quite a bit. And I was trying to think of other examples, so I was going to ask you, can you think of another group that was, you know, going into their 21st year, eighth, ninth, tenth album, and you still enjoyed their new work that they were coming out with at that time? I can think of some solo artists like Dylan and Tom Waits, but I was trying to think of groups that were in that genre.
I mean, it is tricky with bands, right? Because we talk about, you know, there's a it's harder. The artists who we really think of as iconic of reinventing themselves over the course of a multi-decade career. And again, like the idea of a late style in the Edward Said sense for rock artists is a very new one. Right. Like we're still experiencing what it looks like for rock artists to be still putting out work in their 60s and 70s and 80s. So this is still the first first generation of people, your Bob Dylan's, your Neil Young's, who can really be said to have a late style. It's obviously easier, but it seems obvious, but I don't always hear it stated that the people that we look to about your Dylans and Bowies and Neil Youngs, they're solo artists. It's relatively easy for them to reinvent themselves if they want to, right? It's only them taking the risk of challenging their audiences. They can hire a new band if they want a new sound. Mm-hmm. It's just that easy. So a band like a U2 or like an REM or a Radiohead who really want to change it up, they all have to take, you know, hold hands and jump off the cliff together, and take that risk. So, you know, it gets to this question of what our expectations are of bands in their second and third decades in terms of how their sound is going to change. I mean, I often think, and I do read the reviews of Hold Steady Records when they come out. I know you're not supposed to, but of course one does, because you work on these things for a long time and, yeah, you know, and you want to know how they're being received, right? Mm-hmm. You want to know where you are on the stock market. You know, are we up or are we down? And I often think that the reviews fall into two camps, and I feel like we need to get those people in the room together. The camp of people who are like, they're just making the same record over and over again, and the camp of they've strayed too far from the sound that made them great. You know, we need to get them in a room together and let them fight it out, because they can't both be right. Which is a long-winded way of saying I don't have an obvious answer to your question. But I think it's clear to me that we're evolving as a band and that Craig's songwriting is evolving. Like, I think, you know, you listen to, Freddie Knuckles and Distortions of Faith next to each other. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine how you would think that we're still making the same record over and over again, other than the fact that, like, you know, any singer is going to be so distinctive, and Craig is so distinctive in his own right, that's going to be a through line, which I've always sort of thought of as a superpower for us. Like, his voice and his sensibility is so distinctive that we could do literally anything behind it, and it's still going to be identifiable as the Hold Steady.
Now, is that a conscious choice, do you think, on a record like Price of Progress? And is that something that we could expect moving forward in the future, that this idea of like trying other things under that unique voice, because it will all be tied together as the Hold Steady?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I think we're always interested in what are sounds and feels we haven't done before. What are sounds, you know, what's a different flavor in the set list? Mm-hmm. You know, I keep a little, you know, note in my phone of like, when I think of like, oh, what's a feel that we haven't tried. Not everything's going to work with this set of people. But you'd be surprised how often, you know, one of us will throw up a demo that sounds totally off the wall. But once it is played by the six of us, it's going right. to be a hold steady song. And then you've expanded the parameters of what right. constitutes a hold steady song.
So I actually had two more questions that are kind of hold steady geared. I kind of made them fun, if it's all right.
I hate fun.
So within the Hold Steady community, there's often talk about certain songs that feel rare, like everybody's White Whale song. Mm-hmm. Is there a particular song that you haven't had a chance to play often and would love to surprise the crowd with it, like, let's say, a Massive Nights?
If there was, why would I ruin the surprise by saying it?
I'm just trying to get you to say you'll play $40. It's really all it comes down to.
I would love to play $40, but I've stopped proposing it.
Okay. And so my last question is to help settle a rivalry. There's a rivalry between the New York fans and our friends over in the UK over who has the crazier, wilder show, Massive Nights or The Weekenders. So which would you say is a crazier or a wilder crowd, or is there perhaps another city to be put into contention?
Let the editing show that there was a long pause where I thought about this. I don't experience them as substantially different in terms of crazier or wilder. Okay. I really don't. What if do people think that?
So yes, England believes they have the tougher show, and of course New York has to say we have the tougher show. So
I don't think so. I think it really has more to do with what night of the week it is than where it is.
That's definitely fair. So I will say, having gone to both now, there's a weird thing that happens in England where they do this like wave to the front. And like, I've never seen a crowd move like that, where it's literally like pushes to the front and then secedes back and then pushes to the front and you get bounced all over the place. But I still contend that Massive Nights is a crazy night.
I think England doesn't have any seated – they're used to non-seated seats or
– Right. I mean, that's true for New York too, though, but –
Okay. In New York, being in the crowd in New York, everybody gives you more personal space. I call it the Joe Pesci effect. Like you don't want to step on somebody's shoe because they'll go all Joe Pesci on you. Like in the Midwest, people just step all over you. They don't care. But
I'm not being diplomatic. I literally have no opinion on the topic.
Okay, that's fair. Franz, thank you very much for coming on. The book is Band People, available everywhere now. We highly encourage you to check it out because it is really great. Thank you very much for coming on. You were great.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
Ooh,
I love it. That was so much fun. And I would just like to thank Franz again for his time. He's very busy man. And I was just happy he could fit us in, and he was a wonderful person. Just loved it.
Yeah, what a great guest, and really had a good time with that one. I'm glad we got to do it. So yes, thank you very much, Franz. So that being said, Mike, what do we have on the horizon? What's coming next?
Well, it's been a very busy time here at the Hood Rat Recap. So we do have. I know a lot of you might be checking in trying to hear about the Atlanta reviews. We do have some really two big voices from the unified scene coming up. One of them, I think you'll know, one of them's been around for a while, but it'll be a new voice on the show. So they're going to have an Atlanta review. And I want to remind everybody, if you were at Atlanta, send in a voicemail, send in an email, reach out to us on the socials, get it in. Even if you don't get it in for the next episode, which should be coming up really quick, I hope maybe we'll go bang, bang with these episodes. Get it in, because even if it doesn't get on that episode, we'll get it on another episode. And then I know a lot of people we put out the call for Weird Al Yankovic lyrics, and people sent in amazing stuff. And you're like, whatever happened to that? I put a lot of work into that. We really appreciated them. So we wanted to save it to its own episode because it's really good stuff. And so if you have any parody lyrics, hold steady parody lyrics, get them in, because we still have time to get those in, and we might get them on the next episode also.
All right. So if they do want to leave us an Atlanta review or maybe their take on a Hold Steady Weird Al mashup, where could they do that? Like, is there a place they could leave us a message or something, Mike?
Yes. In the show notes, I'm going to put up a link to SpeakPipe. There you can leave us a voicemail. And then I'll put our link tree there. You can go on there. You can get on all our socials. You can get on our email. You can get on the voicemail from there. Just leave us a message in whatever form you wish that works best for you, because this show is about being a voice for the unified scene. So it doesn't work unless we hear your voices, people. So I think everybody that's ever sent something in, we got it in on a episode. We've never skipped over anybody. So if you have a theory that you think the next album is going to be a goth rock themed album, great. Just give us your theory. We'd love to hear them. And that's not all, Gasper. I mean, if we covered a show from last summer and you didn't get your review in from last summer, or let's say you have a favorite show from 10 years ago, or you had something hilarious happen at a show 5 years ago, get it in. We'll cover all of it. We want to hear from you, the unified scene.
Yeah, definitely. And if you're looking for the socials or the SpeakPipe or anything Hood Rat Recap related, past episodes, this current episode, like Mike said, you can head to our link tree. It's linktr.ee/thehoodratrecap. And before we do sign off here, Kevin's not here. He's usually the one who says this, but both Mike and I would really like to thank all of you for all the engagement you have sent so far and for your listens. You guys are great, and you are the reason we do this. We say this is a podcast about the Hold Steady, but honestly, it's a podcast about the community around the Hold Steady, and that's you guys. So thank you so much for everything, and please tell a friend, give us a like, subscribe.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for us. I'm Gasper. That's Mike. And that was the one and only Franz Nicolai. And us guys, and all you guys and gals, we are all the Hood Rat Recap.
Killer parties almost killed me.
Catering for today's guests provided by the fondue machine that the 70s vs. the 80s podcast got at a recent garage sale.
When you walk through the doors at 70s vs. 80s headquarters, you need to be ready to take on the controversial subjects of the 1970s and the 1980s.
Like, for instance, Big Mac versus the Whopper.
Who was the better comedian, Evel Knievel or Super Dave Osborne?
Who did it worse, New Coke or Crystal Pepsi? And we also have hard-hitting discussions. I don't know, Brian, I just always hated that song. Remember the year that Titanic came out and you could just hear that Celine Dion, My Heart Will Go On? You could just hear it everywhere?
Yeah, you'd go to the auto parts store, the grocery store, and the proctologist and be playing at all three of them.
The 70s versus the 80s podcast, available everywhere on your beeper. Smartphone.
What happened to Kevin?
O que aconteceu com o Kevin?
Kevin has a lot of friends, and he loves their collars. Kevin has a lot of friends, and he loves their collars.
Red friend, the ladybug.
Yellow, the bird is yellow.
Yellow, yellow, the bird.